Hello and welcome to the Majlis, a podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. Another cotton season about to start in Central Asia, as every year, millions of people, including farmers, public and private sector workers, even medics and teachers, are expected to take active part in the process from the start to the end. When in its peak, this is a total period of mobilization in at least three Central Asian countries, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan, as millions of citizens, including underage kids, spend days in the field, and the whole process takes months to complete. All this happens under the supervision and watchful eyes of security forces, but despite international outcry, despite the fact that it is against their own national laws, those countries are not giving up on this Soviet-era practice. On today's Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast, we plan to discuss how does this massive mobilization takes place, what effect it has on people, and why authorities aren't giving up on this. To discuss the subject in the panel, I have two names who tirelessly work to monitor this state-sponsored campaign. Ruslan Matiev, editor of Alternative Turkmenistan News, Kirill Boychenko, coordinator of Coalition of NGOs called a Cotton Campaign. In the panel, I also have Steve Serdlo, Human Rights Watch Central Asia researcher, and Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlok Owozi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog. Gentlemen, welcome to the Majlis.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Very nice to have you. So with this, Krill, maybe we can start with you. The cotton season yet to kick off, right?
Well, actually, the preparation of the fields started. In Uzbekistan, weeding season has started, and we see first cases of violations in the fields. Just recent information that we received this week is that medical workers in Chizak region of Uzbekistan and another region in Uzbekistan were forced to clean the fields and prepare them for the harvest.
Ruslan, maybe you could jump in there. Based on signs from last year's harvest and this year's preparation so far, as Kirill just mentioned, what changes do you see in Turkmenistan? And later, maybe, Steve, you can follow up the changes in Uzbekistan since we have a new president.
Well, frankly speaking, I don't expect any changes this season. Alternative Turkmenistan News has been conducting this monitoring since the season of 2013. And to my evaluation, things are getting worse and worse each season. More and more people are being forced to pick cotton. The government, the top leadership of the Turkmen government, criticizes the regional governors and officials for not fulfilling the quotas. And they, in their turn, force civil servants to pick more and travel to the fields more often. At the same time, we see a lot of pressure on individuals who try to document instances of forced labor. And this pressure means for them prison terms, intimidation, harassment at work, etc., etc.
Mm-hmm. Talking about Uzbekistan, so especially it's important because we have a new president. Any changes this year compared to the previous year? Steve, Krill, jump in.
You know, I think the larger context here is really important. There's an enormous amount of discussion about how, what has changed and what hasn't changed in Uzbekistan. And there's a flurry, a euphoria almost among many of the diplomats that we speak to and representatives of some of the international organizations who have been, after a decade of being shut out of Uzbekistan, going there in droves almost from an Uzbek perspective. You've had the High Commissioner for Human Rights from the United Nations, Prince Hussein, visiting Uzbekistan in the last 2 weeks and making a statement. And that was a very, very significant event. Yeah. And you've had international financial institutions engaging, and many of them have pointed to what they see as the major changes on cotton as evidence that you now have a kinder, gentler Uzbek government and regime and system. But the problem is is that it's very hard to verify that those claims are actually true. But so far, the evidence on the ground is that the repressive system remains almost unchanged. In March this year, we saw our colleague and human rights defender, Yelena Orlaeva, beaten by police on the way to a meeting to brief the World Bank about what was happening in the cotton harvest, and then forcibly consigned to a psychiatric hospital and kept there for over a month. And so we continue to see over a million adults forced into picking cotton. So on the one hand, I think President Mirziyoyev is striking a lot of positive notes rhetorically, but as of yet, until we can actually verify what's going on in the cotton season this year and the weeding system, which has just started, I think it's premature to say that there have been improvements. In fact, we're troubled by what seems to be the same patterns repeating themselves. Mm-hmm.
Bruce, earlier we were talking about Mirziyoyev, since came to power, has touched to a number of things. And the cotton, or maybe the agriculture, is something that he continues with the legacy of previous president. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, well, of course, that is one of the glaring examples of no change, actually, in Uzbekistan, is we haven't heard anything about the cotton campaign past some vague promise of the fact that Russia is going to help them build a tractor factory, you know, for farming machinery. And sometime in 2020 or after that, they're going to have more mechanized farming of the cotton fields. But that's about as far as it's gone. And I think it's really important, you know, focus on the fact that Kirill just mentioned that the clearing of the fields is happening in Jizak province, and that, of course, is Mirziyoyev's home province.
Yeah.
And so you would think if any change was going to happen at all, it would be there, because he would be more informed about what was happening and be more familiar with the officials working there. So the fact that we hear now that Jizak is already, the preparations for the cotton harvest are already underway, indicates that we got no change coming at all.
It might sound, you know, that we are repeating some known facts here, but I think it's worth to remember earlier, Ruslan, you alluded to that. How does the period of mobilization looks like when it happens?
Well, in Turkmenistan, the forced labor, its ugliest form, begins in late August and continues throughout the fall and ends somewhere mid-December, depending on the amount of harvest and the weather conditions outside. Every public institution, like a public school or a hospital or a bank or a factory, you name it, receive quota assigned by the governor of that region. And of course, the governor receives this quota from the center, from Ashgabat. Then every such public organization, they split this quota among themselves. And each particular school or a hospital receives the amount of cotton that they need to submit eventually at the end of the season. And then inside of those organizations, of those public institutions, they decide who is going to take turns, who is going to go where, to which fields, to which regions, for how long, and how much they need to pick every day. Usually it is the quota stays at 50 kilograms per day, but early in the season, of course, it's not possible to meet that quota for obvious reasons, because cotton is not there yet. But closer to end of September and to mid-October, this is basically feasible. And demands may raise closer to the mid-season. So this is how it works, basically. People travel every morning to the fields. A bus comes to pick them up, and later the same bus, in most of the cases, brings them back to the city. The next day, another shift would go to the field. In organizations like public utility services, there are several day shifts. For instance, people can go for a 10-day trip, which means that they need to take their sleeping stuff, like mattresses, pillows, etc., and they literally sleep in the fields or in the gym, in the gyms of public schools in those regions. So they travel for 10, 15, and even longer, even more days during such assignments.
This is the picture from Turkmenistan during the total mobilization. Is the process any different in Uzbekistan, Kirill?
Well, it's very interesting, and I think it's very relevant when you say, Mohammed, that maybe we repeat certain things again. But it seems very important to repeat these things, because the both governments, they try to change the narrative all the time.
Right.
So we see the reporting and monitoring and cases of forced labor in both countries. But the governments make declarations that this practice is abolished, that they're past the stage of child labor, and now they have a very small problem with forced labor, whether this is not the case. So what we see, and both countries are similar in terms of the state orchestrated system of forced labor, and this is quite unique. And for practitioners around the world that work on modern day slavery, cases of Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and Tajikistan are unique because the governments, they act as perpetrators. Sort of they are the traffickers of their own citizens. And the systems are similar in terms of what Ruslan just described. I just wanted to give you some illustration of 2016 cotton harvest from our great partners and colleagues, Uzbek-German Forum for Human Rights. Right. They did an independent monitoring and reporting from Uzbekistan, and they worked with activists on the ground, and they recorded over 1 million forced laborers during 2016 cotton harvest, and among them 200,000 students of higher education institutions, 200,000 college students, and 600,000 employees of public and private organizations. And those are teachers, doctors, and this is happening again, just like it happened years before. And we don't see the change, unfortunately, but even with the change in administration, we don't see the change in the state-run system of forced labor.
If possible, let's also mention the case of Gaspar Matalaev, an activist from Turkmenistan who did monitoring in 2016 and before, and who was arrested last year for precisely this activity, and subsequently sentenced to 3 years in prison on false charges. Also, Kirill mentioned some numbers related to Uzbekistan and the numbers of people. I also have some figures here. We calculated the total number of schools in Turkmenistan. We removed the Akhal region where the cotton is not picked. We removed the same way Balkan region. And from the three remaining regions, almost 46,000 teachers pick cotton on a daily basis.
How does this happen in Tajikistan, Steve?
It's interesting that the Tajikistan is somewhat different because of land reform and the way it was handled. And I think because of Tajikistan's more, perhaps its dependence on donors and some of the differences in terms of the diplomatic posture a decade ago, things started to change. Although, you know, Kirill and Ruslan describe a system that's very similar. It's just somewhat less centralized. We were doing research in Dangara, the home region of President Rahmon, about 3 years ago, where we documented kids being forced out into the fields on school days, on Saturdays, being beaten when they didn't meet their quotas. So it was still the government that was actually trafficking people, but that it appeared to be not centralized in a national way, but more in a regional way or a local way. And we don't have the same figures, the same overall scale and scope of child or forced adult labor. So things changed a bit in the past decade. But I think the problem is still there, and it's unseen. And certainly as the economic climate there has declined during the crisis over the past few years, I imagine that it exists more than we're able to actually report on and document. So it's still a key problem, and it's still intertwined with the state.
Bruce, last year, quite a tragic incidents were reported from the cotton fields of Uzbekistan, thanks to Ozotlik, the Uzbek Service of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, with whom you closely work. We have at least some idea that what's happening there. What are the incidents that are common on the ground in the cotton fields there?
Well, probably the most common incident is suicides. People who fail to pick the quota that's been designated to them, and then they're humiliated by local officials. Sometimes they're physically abused by local officials, and they end up going and hanging themselves or finding some other way to commit suicide. But beyond that, you also have a lot other incidents of people simply, it's hot. They're long days. Some of these shifts go anywhere from 12, 16 hours or something. They don't get a whole lot of sleep. And when the shift is over, over, at the end of the day, people are just exhausted. They end up crossing the road and not paying enough attention and getting run over. You know, I mean, we had this very unfortunate incident of a child that was in the fields in Uzbekistan, and he decided to. I'm not sure he was actually picking cotton, but his parents were, or at least one of his parents was, and he just went to sleep in a trailer with a bale of cotton, and they just kept throwing more and more cotton on top of him, and he suffocated. You know, so these are the kind of incidents that you see really every year.
So this is the picture. Now, the massive abuse of human labor and basic rights takes place despite continued international outcry, despite that it is against the national laws of those nations. What to do about this? And what steps are taken so far, both by national governments, international communities, to stop this practice, and what the outcome have been so far? So we will continue the debate discussing this and many other questions shortly. Hey everyone, before we get into the second part of the show, just a quick reminder that if you really like Majlis podcast, there's a real chance that you will also like my other radio show that's called Gandhara Podcast. The show discusses latest developments in Pakistan and Afghanistan from local perspective. And the podcast is published in every second week on Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's Gandhara website. It's a totally must-follow discussion for foreign policy nerds with interest in the region. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia podcast. We are discussing annual cotton campaign in Central Asia and it has short and long-term implications. Joining me in the discussion are Ruslan Matiev, editor of Alternative Turkmenistan News, who conducts hands-on monitoring of the situation in Turkmenistan; Kirill Boychenko, coordinator of Cotton Campaign Coalition of NGOs, which fights against forced labor in the cotton fields of Central Asia; Steve Sivertlu, Central Asia researcher at the Human Rights Watch, who defends the rights of people; and Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlak Awazi, Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, who documents these developments in his writings. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, gentlemen. So, mother of all questions is why authorities in at least three Central Asian countries, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan, aren't giving up on this Soviet-era practice? Maybe, Bruce, we can start with you.
Well, I mean, it's an easy way to make money. Cotton, ever since independence, has been one of the surefire ways of getting hard currency. So there's never, you know, they really need that. And let me put that in perspective a little bit for you, too. Now, Uzbekistan is not a major natural gas exporter, but it does export natural gas. The amount of money they will get for their natural gas exports to Russia this year, which admittedly are only 5 billion cubic meters, is approximately the same amount of money that they'll get for cotton sales. Mm. So it is that kind of importance to the Central Asian governments. You know, another one of the problems is who's buying the cotton, too. I mean, it's easy. There's been a big campaign, and Kirill, of course, would know a lot about this, you know, in the West, to like not buy cotton from these kind of people. But in Uzbekistan's case, for instance, the major purchaser of Uzbek cotton is China, and they don't care, you know, so. More than half of Uzbek cotton is, which they always have a big cotton fair every year in October, and China comes and buys a bunch of it. And then you look at the list of the other countries that buy it, and almost all of them are countries that aren't really. I mean, they have their own rights problems that are frequently mentioned by international organizations. So they're kind of in the same boat as Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan, where they're all criticized for their rights records. So they don't have any problem buying the cotton from them. And like I said, for the governments in those regions, it's a surefire way to get hard currency. All of them need hard currency now. They're having severe economic problems. So, you know, having a cheap labor force that you can pay next to nothing to go out and harvest your cotton and get it so that they can market it at a international fair or to international buyers, it's ingrained in the system. It's a way that they've just become accustomed to making money over the last 25 years.
Hmm. How does the hierarchy involved in this practice? I mean, enforcer seems to be district mayors. Do you think the order comes from the president, Ruslan?
Absolutely. When it comes to Turkmenistan, I have not a single doubt that this order comes from the president. In Turkmenistan, every case, every detail is decided by him. Even the smallest thing, as I don't know, the way a flag should be installed on a newly built, newly erected building. I mean, in Turkmenistan, he literally decides on everything.
This is, earlier you used the word krill, modern-day slavery, describing this situation. Ruslan tells us that this order, I mean, this practice takes its root from the presidential office. Probably it's the same with the other two countries in Central Asia. So how does the authorities respond when confronted with the questions? I guess you had a quite interesting discussion this year in Geneva involving cotton, and where the representatives from some of the Central Asian countries were present.
This is a very good question. The thing is, at the beginning, the government of Uzbekistan would deny that there is a problem. And right now, they changed this rhetoric to accepting that there is a problem, but they are working hard to correct it. But unfortunately, what we see is that there are many paper exercises. Some plans are signed, some documents being discussed, international conventions being ratified. But the real tangible reforms on the ground is something that we yet see. The enforcement of laws, that's the problem. Even when the government publicly gives statements that forced labor is a crime, at the same time, it gives directives to regional governors and administrators, hokims, to continue this practice, or they will be punished. And law enforcement enforces this practice. So on one hand, you have information for the outside world, and Uzbek citizens, they themselves say that this is not for us. For us is forced labor in the fields. This information, or something you see on the banners about hotline on forced labor, this is for international monitors. So there is a clear differentiation of different informational channels. And also something I wanted to build on what Bruce said, that cotton and forced labor in cotton, it's about money, of course, yes, but it's also about control. Imagine if the authoritative country over decades and decades forces annually hundreds and hundreds of its citizens. It breaks the will, it controls, and it's one of the means to do it. Then the system is corrupt, or absolutely corrupt. We don't know where proceeds from sale of cotton are going. I don't think that that Majlis has information and parliamentarians have information where the money goes. And it's also a long history of propaganda when citizens are being told, this is your civic duty, let's stand up for the motherland, this is our white gold, the cotton, and it becomes another story. So the system is nuanced. That's why at the cotton campaign, we come to stopping this problem from many different angles.
You know, Steve, yes, we are criticizing the cotton production, the abuses comes with it, but there won't be a production if there won't be a demand. The question is how to avoid this. Is there any mechanism through which it can be avoided? The forced labor can be stopped, or how to deal with this internationally?
Just to pick up on a bit of what Kirill and Ruslan were saying, it is about money. It's also about repression. This is very much the DNA of these regimes. And, you know, I think over time, you know, some of the friends of this podcast, like Alex Cooley, have written about how over time the Central Asian governments have learned to play the game exceedingly well in terms of deflecting criticism. And, you know, I think cotton is a real case in point, in the sense that, at least in the Uzbek case and on other human rights abuses, the lesson seems to be, if you repeat a lie long enough, it'll become true. And, you know, we were speaking earlier about the recent diplomatic euphoria, in a way, about the supposed improvements in Uzbekistan. And we have heard from some of our sources on the ground that President Mirziyoyev himself has recently been taking credit for the reduction in child labor that occurred over the past several years. Of course, he, as prime minister, was primarily responsible for enforcing agricultural production. And, you know, we know very well about his repressive tactics to enforce farmers meeting their quotas and threatening to take the slate out of their roofs if they didn't deliver their quotas. But he himself has actually been taking credit for these changes when we know full well that it was an international boycott, it was international pressure, it was the threat of certain sanctions, it was the State Department. listing Uzbekistan as a trafficker of cotton that brought about some of the improvements that we did see earlier. And so, you know, I think this is about international pressure. It's about supporting international and local civil society to actually monitor what happens. I mean, we don't have any of that, unfortunately, in Turkmenistan. No eyes on the ground, no way to verify government claims of what's actually going on. We have seen when it comes to Uzbekistan, the picture is problematic because we have the International Labor Organization, which has been monitoring the cotton fields. And of course, that's an incredibly important aspect of this. The Cotton Campaign and Human Rights Watch called for many years for the Uzbek government to let the ILO in and do monitoring. But what we've seen is that the monitoring is not truly independent. People like Yelena Orlaeva still get picked up and put into psychiatric hospitals when they try to go out into the fields. And so what we need to see, and we've been calling on the government to do this for many years, is to allow local groups, outside groups, groups like the Uzbek German Forum for Human Rights, to go out into the fields without harassment, without threat of being jailed, and report on what's happening. I think we also need to see the World Bank step up and actually fulfill its obligations. It's making major investments into Uzbekistan's agricultural sector. I should flag that we have a report at Human Rights Watch that will be coming out soon in the next 2 months about the World Bank's responsibility to hold Uzbekistan accountable where it finds that forced labor and child labor are occurring in its own projects. The World Bank has conditions that they place on Uzbekistan when they give them money for agricultural reform, and one of those conditions is that there can be no forced labor or child labor in World Bank projects. And yet, as Kirill said, in 2015 and 2016, we saw just that happening. So the World Bank needs to say to Uzbekistan, the money stops until you allow truly independent monitoring and you allow activists to do their job.
Maybe, Krill, you can jump in here. Earlier, Steve alluded to that there is not a clear picture from the ground what is happening. Also, reporting from Uzbekistan is so difficult that we have cases like Orlyaeva. If that is the case, it's also because of the authorities. They don't let you to monitor the situation on the ground. So in this situation, is the existing mechanism is enough to deal with this situation?
We need support, and we need support for human rights defenders that risk their lives every day working on the ground in Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan.
Yeah, that's the point well taken, Akril. But my question was, if there is not a possibility to report or monitor the situation on the ground, it is also because of the authorities. My question is, the mechanism that we have today, the tools that we have today to convince those authorities is sufficient to deal with the situation. You understand the forced labor in the cotton field continues despite these criticism by various NGOs, international organization, UN, for example, but it continues. And it also that they don't let you to report about that transparently. So my question is, the existing system, is it sufficient to deal with the situation?
No, absolutely not. And because cotton is a global supply chain commodity, and because it's a major cash crop for many countries, and it's a high demand export product, it's been bought by many different companies. And it's an obligation of the companies to look into their supply chains and excuse that we have suppliers and sub-suppliers and it's 3, 4, 5 layers are not good enough. There is legislation in the U.S. It's the U.S. Tariff Act. In the U.K. is the U.K. Modern Day Slavery Act. There are other countries that enforce similar legislation that prohibit imports of products that are made with forced labor. And companies have to look into this. And non-governmental organizations and human rights activists are their eyes and ears. And therefore, they have to be allowed to do their work, to document and report the concerns, because otherwise we are looking at the system that is stained with modern day slavery, whether products are being bought and sold without any accountability and transparency. Mm-hmm. So the system is not good at the moment and it has to change.
Mm-hmm. Can I just add a thought here? is that, you know, we also don't know what the impact of the Trump administration is really going to be on Central Asian human rights, although so far the signs we're seeing are not good in terms of the much lessened influence or importance being placed on those issues. So there should be a trafficking in persons report coming out this summer, most likely by that the State Department puts out every year. And we don't know if Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan are going to be ranked in the categories that they should, that is the worst of the worst. But that's a really important symbol that's sent to these governments. And you know, we saw that the few improvements that did take place in Uzbekistan starting 4 years ago happened, and when the ILO was actually allowed in, that happened directly in 2013, immediately after the State Department had taken steps to sanction Uzbekistan. So if the pressure lets up, nothing changes. I think that's really the story. And we saw earlier this year the European Parliament, which had been a voice for standing up to these abuses in 2011 and refused to sign off on tariff and extending certain economic privileges and benefits to Uzbek cotton coming into European markets, they actually took a step backwards and approved a textile protocol that allows Uzbek cotton to come into European markets more easily. And that was despite the vocal criticisms voiced by our partners in Uzbek civil society. So it's been a mixed bag. We've seen the pressure waning, I would say, over the past 2 years. And the euphoria around the supposed changes in post-Karim of Uzbekistan, I think, doesn't really necessarily help the 32 million citizens of that country get free of these abuses.
Okay, two quick questions, Ruslan, first to you. So you have been involved in the campaign run by the NGOs, the advocacy campaign, trying to convince various international companies to not buy cotton from Central Asia. Is it making any difference?
It's a good question. We have just recently started engaging with foreign companies. But the problem is, as Bruce mentioned, China is buying most of it. And unfortunately, this trend is seen or will be foreseen in the coming seasons in Turkmenistan as well. We have managed, together with the cotton campaign, to get several companies, several brands, publicly refuse sourcing cotton from Turkmenistan or products made of Turkmen cotton. Yes, it is some sort of success, but how big is this success in terms of revenues? We cannot compare how much their refusal will affect the Turkmen government versus, for instance, China buying raw cotton, or Pakistan buying, or Bangladesh buying raw cotton from the government. I'm less optimistic in this sense, but at the same time, we need to continue working, and we are now engaged with another big chain. I will not name it, but we're still in the process of discussing it.
Okay, Bruce, a final point. So what has to happen to change this stalemate situation?
You know, mechanization would help a little bit because it would free some of these people up. If there was true privatization of some of these cotton plantations, or you know, I suppose that would help. I mean, there's no reason in the world why someone couldn't actually own the cotton plantation, and you run it regularly where you have workers who you pay a fair wage and they go out and get you know, and take care of the cotton harvesting. It would reduce the amount of people involved in it, you know, substantially, and it would be a more open and legitimate process at that point, you know. But I mean, Kirill raised a really good point by saying that the government couches these things as a patriotic duty, and so they have this veneer over the top of it. If it's not, you know, you're not being forced into the field as a slave or anything like that. You're part of the whole process of bringing our nation up and moving us forward. I mean, that's something else that's also got to stop. And I suppose organizations like RFARL should keep broadcasting as much as possible that you're being used. You're being used as a slave. There's not much difference than that, or being chained to a post and told to do work all day. But, you know, I mean, this is going to have to change the mindset of the people, and really whatever pressure you can put on the government to stop this and try to make it a more legitimate form of agriculture would help.
Okay. Thank you very much for your insightful comment. Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlak Ovozi, Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Ruslan Matiev, editor of Alternative Turkmenistan News. Kirill Boychenko, coordinator of Cotton Campaign. Steve Sivertlu, Central Asia researcher at the Human Rights Watch. Thank you very much for your time. In touch, gentlemen. This is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast. Until next week, bye-bye.